We've been told about that it no longer blinks. Where are we? The Joint Interim Task Force on High School and Transition Success for Students with Disabilities will come to order. You're up, Senator Springer.
Hi.
Next time we need a shorter title for our committee.
Yes.
That's a mouthful. Will you get on that, Representative Springer?
Sure. Consider it done.
Should be a permanent amendment for short titles for task forces. So we have a pretty short agenda today. Mr. Boren is going to give a presentation and share some concerns about meeting more diverse student needs in transition programs. And we were going to start going through the recommendations that we've collected. Victoria sent yesterday something I'm not especially, it's not well formatted. And for those of you that are former English teachers, I know there's grammatical problems and formatting errors, but I thought it was more important to get it out than to not. So one of the things I hope we can do today after we go through that is maybe put together a team that can spend some time figuring out the smartest way to format our recommendations and put a narrative with it that maybe helps people understand what the issues are. And I'm sure we've missed some recommendations as well, so we'll go through that later. But maybe we can start just by quick introductions around the room. We have a special guest with us at the table today. And do you want to start, Danielle?
Hi, I'm Danielle Sheldrake. I'm the Administrator for Student Services for the Beaverton School District.
And I'm Sarah Mendez. I'm the Registrar at Sausset High School.
Raina Mattson, Newport High School and Newport Prep Academy Counselor.
Mike Maley with the Department of Human Services.
I'm Morning Principal of Corvallis High School, and I brought Aaron, my son, with me.
He's
a student at Corvallis High School this year, thanks to a change in the law. He's a transfer student, so he goes to work with me. And since I live here in St. Louis, we haven't been to work yet, so he's with us, and then we're going to school, aren't we, bud?
The adult call.
After school.
I'm Clint DeLong, pre-vocational rehabilitation.
I'm Susan Deegan. I'm with the Office of Student Access and Completion up until July 1. Before July 1, we were the Oregon Student Access Commission. Our agency name changed.
Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17.
Victoria Cox, Administrator.
And Zoe. I'm Sarah Gelser, State Representative from Corvallis and Philomath, and I chair the House Ed Committee.
I'm Michael Dembro, Senator from District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast Portland.
Great.
Let's see if we have any.
Oh, yes, and we've got people on the phone.
Maybe not. Anyone on the phone?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, Chris Bendefke, Counselor from Philomath School District.
Great. Anyone else on the phone? No. And then we usually introduce our guests in this room or the members of the audience. I actually know all of you. So.
Hi, my name is Gordon Roth. I'm here mostly because this is something that I think is important, but I'm mostly ignorant on, so I want to learn more.
My name is Felicia. I'm currently an intern at the governor's office, and and the Georgia representative Sarah Gelser. I'm also interested in the topic, so very happy to be here.
Serena Summer, last week, also director of equity and community development.
I'm Ronelle Shankle, here today as a citizen. I'm the parent of a young adult with developmental disabilities.
Great. So with that, why don't we start with Matt?
Sure. I wanted to talk about just a concern that I've had since I've gone into...
You might need the microphone so that we can record you forever.
Oh, good. And you can... There we go. Okay, so Matt Boring, Corvallis High School. When I arrived at Corvallis High School, I noticed a couple things. One, we had a very strong life skills program, one that Aaron's involved in now, and it has a lot of support, and there's a good transition program
for those kids, I think, the WINGS program. But we have another chunk of kids, and even though I hate the word, I call them tweeners, their skills really are too high for WINGS in a lot of ways, but too low for community college or even, you know, community college type certification training programs.
And Matt, would you explain what WINGS is? I know what WINGS is because my son is in it, but just to put it in terms of
sure.
districts, what the
sure. WINGS, don't ask me what WINGS, if it's an acronym, because I don't know. I think I tend to think of it in the more metaphorical sense anyway. But WINGS is really the next step for our 18 to 21-year-old students who graduate from our life skills program, some with modified diplomas, some with alternative diplomas. Aaron will join WINGS in a couple of years, and it does work on independence, certainly, and some job skills, getting out in the community. And one thing that we've found with life skills as we have it set up, we do, I think, an outstanding job of pushing kids out into classrooms, and it limits what we can do getting kids out in the community in the kind of 15 to 18-year-old age group. And so WINGS, you know, does a lot better job with that. And so I feel comfortable with how we're transitioning kids there, but extremely uncomfortable then for those kids in between. They tend to graduate mostly with modified diplomas, and that's it, really. I mean, their services end. I mean, there are some voc rehab resources, kind of. It's a process. It's a process that families don't always get enough support to get even aligned with in the first place. And so I'm not a real let's just ignore the issue kind of guy. And so in working with one of our LRC teachers, we decided, well, we're going to do something. And so we started a little program called Independent Living Skills and Employment Skills. I don't know where I found FTE to do it. But so we have a couple periods a day where we're keeping the kids, essentially. They've graduated with their modified diplomas, but they're coming back. And we have about 12 kids right now. Some kids from other districts actually want to come in, and it's gotten a little bit there's some red tape involved with that, but we'll work through it. But it's a start. I'm missing Professional Wednesday right now. The kids dress up and really try to look the part of their next step. I won't miss Breakfast Friday. They make breakfast. It's actually good. Had it last Friday, pancakes and eggs. A young lady named Tanya had never cracked an egg in her life, done any kind of cooking, and she was taking orders. She could, hey, bud. Oh, you dropped a card. Dropped a baseball card, sorry. You know, she would ask, you know, want them scrambled, fried egg, over easy. I mean, just did 2 weeks. And so that part's pretty cool. And we're trying to, we don't have a YTP grant yet, and Lord knows why. We'll get on that process now. But we also have some of the kids taking, you know, they take more than the independent living class. A girl I'm thinking of, great kid, she's also taking pre-algebra. I mean, that's where she is at age 19. And that's okay. There are two benefits to that. She needs to fill in some holes in her math, but she's a leader in pre-algebra, and she's actually practicing some of the soft skills that we're working on because, you know, there are a lot of knucklehead ninth graders in pre-algebra, as you can imagine. And so it's worked that way. This is a skeleton program. I'm interested in hearing what other folks are doing. If I had a, you know, if the Capitol ever gets to 21st century, I could just from my phone put a picture on the screen. The kids yesterday all registered to vote. They were very excited about that, and there's a great picture that the teacher sent me. We'll do things like get first aid cards, food handler's license, that kind of thing. One thing I'm frustrated with, I'll just throw this out here. What we wanted to start second semester was the kids working with a coffee cart, an espresso cart, because we have some very generous parents in Corvallis who could set us up with a lot of things, but we're running up against regulations about caffeine and that sort of thing, that which frustrates me when 400 students every morning show up with a Dutch Brothers cup. And it's really those kinds of issues that slow us down with some things that we want to do, and also I think undermine community support too. We have these parent volunteers who we can get you all your supplies for nothing. I own four of these Dutch Brothers and things like that, and so I get frustrated just anyway because I'm an impatient guy, but the clock's ticking for the kids. And that's kind of where we are with that, but at least in Corvallis, that's been a hole. And so other districts I know have great YTP programs, and we will get on that train. But I've found just the getting started has brought more energy to it. For instance, our voc rehab counselor comes into the school now, and she changed her schedule and went to her supervisor and said, I want to be in the school. And she's in 5 hours a week, and I'd only met her twice in 3 years, prior to that. There just weren't systems in place to help these kids. So we're on the right track, but I just think that it's a need statewide. I think that, Aaron is well taken care of in the educational system. And, hang on here. Bill. Plays for the Blue Jays, if that needs to be in the record. but these other kids aren't. And I'm glad that we have a guest from an equity lens here, because if we're talking about these kids as they exist in Corvallis High School, you would think we had a very diverse town, and we don't. It's disproportionately Latino students. Who have been in our district since kindergarten, first grade. And so I think it's very much an equity issue, and it needs to be addressed through that lens as well. And so there you have it.
One talk.
That's where we're coming from. But I really want to be involved or get in conversation with districts who do this kind of thing better than we do, because we're behind.
What are some of the other districts doing? Are you struggling with these?
Well, so in Beaverton, we have two setups. So we have what we call a CTP program, Community Transition Program. And so several years ago, with one of the bonds that passed, the district had purchased a building, and we've actually relocated the CTP program over to an off-site location, because one of the things we ran into is we had students who were in served by our life skills program, and returning to a comprehensive high school did not break the ties of, the shifting to adult life. And so we really wanted to get to a point that we had an off-site location. So we've grown that program from, it started with one class. This year we were up to four classrooms. We were serving about 60 students at that site. We have four teachers, and then we have transition program assistants, TPAs. So they're classified staff, but in their job description, they're able to go out into the community with students. And so they have about a 1-to-3 staffing ratio. And so students come into the program in the morning, they do their daily routine, they look at their calendar, their work schedule, all of those pieces, and then they deploy to multiple work job sites within the community. The benefit in Beaverton is we have a TriMet, so we have public transportation. So through that program, they learn how to ride TriMet independently, to get to their work sites, to do all of those pieces. And then they have Friday outings where they go to really fun leisure activity type things. So as an adult, what do you enjoy for a hobby? You know, what kind of, they go to the car show every year, which is a big event, because that's something as an adult, you're gonna maybe buy a car. So they work on all of those pieces. And to, in order to build to that, we have a high school program where with funding cuts, we've had to kind of pare back some of our transition specialist support, but we've moved to a district model, which actually has been really successful. So we have two highly trained transition specialists that work with our comprehensive high schools. They go out and work with the resource teachers, and then we have staff that run the work experience program. And Matt, I should have you hook up with my two transition teachers, because they ran into the same issue around food, selling food, because they were battling the student body. Or so they've gotten, they got some grants, and we've funded screen printing machines. So they're doing T-shirts for different activities, and they do the graphic art design. So they work with the art design department. And then now they're moving to lawn signs and signs, doing those pieces. So it's really, and they're, and now they're sustaining the job. And so they're building, and they have, like, when we have events, we go to them and we ask them to make things, you know, and they're great. And it's a usable trade outside other than just kind of the custodial type work. And so we target our 16 to 18 year olds. So our, sophomores, juniors, and seniors who participate in that program. And it's starting to build the work experience opportunities so they'd be ready for our community transition program. So I feel like in Beaverton, we've been pretty successful around that. When I was in my prior district, which was smaller, what we ran into is we built a transition program, and it had to be in a comprehensive high school because we didn't have 60 kids.
Right.
We had 12. And so we had to build that program, and we had drivers, VOC drivers, so that, because they have to drive the student to the work site. So one of the hangups we have, whether it's in Beaverton or in my prior district, is the job sites, finding partnerships. We have a lot of community businesses that are worried about insurance liability. You can't get into sites that have unions, because then the worry is that you're taking union jobs away from employees. So that is always kind of, we've lost job sites, like Dollar Tree used to be one of ours, but there was a problem nationally, and so they pulled away from that. So that is difficult. And I think, Matt, what you're talking about, where we're falling down on, is the kids who are graduate with a modified diploma, potentially because they can't pass the math requirements, and that kind of hinders them. They might have a math disability, and so they can't, they're, with all the supports we're providing them, they're not able to pass OAKS, they're not able to pass Algebra 2. And they graduate, and we're kind of, that program isn't appropriate for them. Coming and, you know, making, for them, coming and doing, you know, daily living skills isn't what they need. They need more of that higher level employment-based factors. And then what we run into is, you know, we have the 990 hours, which we offer them, but for them, it ends up them back in math classes that they don't necessarily want to take. And so that's where kind of what we want to try to look at is, with the ability to access community college funds, how can we access that 18 to 21, and how do we support students with a transition to community college, and building a relationship with community college where maybe some of their ADM dollars are able to pay for courses, but some kind of relationship. Because those are the kids that I don't think every special ed director I've talked to, they haven't quite figured that out.
So if there was a way for the ADM to pay for community colleges, which there is, because we do it for a bunch of our kids through the Running Start program, would that allow, since they're still in special ed in the school district, would that allow enhanced support provided by the district in terms of study skills and other kinds of classroom supports like they might have had in high school to help them get through a two-year degree or a professional certificate?
And that's what we have to work on. We haven't built that relationship. The other thing is some of the courses require prerequisites that the student may not be at that current level to take. But the interesting thing is, even if they haven't met the prerequisite, if we had a learning specialist, a transition teacher, who were the liaison doing, on-site doing the study skills, those kids still may be successful in that school environment, even though they haven't passed the compass or whatever that requirement is. And so that's where we have to build, I feel like, some opportunities for those kids that are more systematic as a state, because we're losing. Those are the kids who aren't coming back, because why would they want to come back to Sunset High School? And they don't want to go to CTP because they're like, well, that's not who I am. And it's this weird dichotomy, and that we just haven't really looked at. I feel like from my experience, a lot of the laws and the regulations that have come out, the focus has been around kind of this life skills population, and we're missing the boat on kids that is probably a larger percentage of our graduates than this smaller pocket over here. And how do we help them attain gainful employment or get a degree or those pieces there?
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Senator Denbrough.
Yeah, Danielle, so I assume that most of your students would be taking classes at PCC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and each PCC campus has, an LD specialist, or someone who's a specialist for students with an office of students with disabilities. So, how much do you interact with them?
So, our transition specialists, they work with helping students access those services at the university or PCC. But the different role for them is the specialist at PCC, for instance, their job is just to try to help them identify what accommodations they need and making sure they know how to advocate for those accommodations, which is very different than teaching the skills that maybe they're lacking. And so that's pretty much what the relationship is that, the specialist at PCC is just trying to tell the student, because we can't go on their behalf, they have to go on their own to work with them to see how to access that. And you're nodding your head, Clint, so I'm assuming that's been kind of your experience as well?
Pretty much, yeah. We deal with Chemeketa Community College, but it's the same thing. The student has to go. Book rehab can provide often the documentation needed to establish the learning disabilities that need accommodations, but the disability liaison with the college just helps the student advocate and set up the accommodations and how to talk to the teachers about that so that they are accommodated.
So just to follow up, I'm just wondering if that's a process that could be improved, or if there's a need for improvement, and where there would be more interaction between the high school transitions people and the community college people, and if so, what would that take? What would that look like?
I think a big piece of that is working at the university level around kind of the expectations from a public school standpoint, I think you could work on that. I think when they came and talked, there was the last session we had, we had the universities come and speak, and they were talking about tests and stuff. It's how do, are there grant dollars available to them to be able to take a little bit more ownership of students with disabilities to help with supporting them in the skills? Because I think, and I said this at the last meeting, my transition specialists know how to help support to get to that step, to maybe get to college, to get to PCC, to get into a transition program. And my counselors know that as well, but they don't know the aspects of the actual university setting, and some of the specialists there, I feel like, are a lot more just the idiosyncrasies of that component, yet they don't necessarily provide that support. So we could train up our specialists, but they're not going to know that detail, and it's how do we encourage universities to pick up some of that, I think, would be great, because then that could build a bridge between the school districts and the post-secondary education piece.
Yeah.
I don't know what your experience has been.
Well, that's kind of the same thing, and it's an ironic circle that kids get or cycle that kids get caught in, because the community college is sort of insisting, at least indirectly, on a level of self-advocacy that I'm not quite sure we got kids there, you know, certain kids to that level. And some of that's part of their challenge in the first place. And so if a kid isn't really proactive in trying to get services, the schools aren't coming to them, let's put it that way. And it also, they're at an age where mom and dad, if they're around and are supportive, are really tired of being the driver of their kid's education. And so they get, the process stops, we've found. And then the kids get a little frustrated with their college, and they're maybe one quarter and done, and no real credits, or the reality of paying for a class that doesn't earn credit because it's underneath, it's math 50 or whatever. So,
and I think even if the parents aren't tired, there's laws that prevent the parent from then accessing the information.
Absolutely.
So even if you had a special ed teacher who was able, like we have an early college program, not a lot of our students with disabilities access it, then that's something we want to look into. But we have a special ed teacher who's on site, and she teaches a study skills kind of class. Most of the kids are on track for a standard diploma, though. They can't then go and talk directly on the behalf of the student to the university or PCC. The student has to do it. And so that sometimes becomes the barrier. And if the university had someone who was kind of the advocate for that student, which ideally you would see, they would be able to, how do you navigate that and look at that system? Because I think even if we were able to use our ADM, we had a system to use the ADM dollars to pay for them to go to PCC, there's quite a few roadblocks in order for that to be successful, in terms of the student having to register, the student having to advocate. And we want to get there, but it doesn't mean just because they don't have haven't attained those skills doesn't mean they're not going to be successful in the class. And so that, I think, is a barrier for many of our students who graduate with modified diploma, who could very well attain a certificate at PCC, CCC, Chemeketa. But that becomes one of the barriers for them.
I can share also about Lincoln County. I think one thing that we would love to see is a transition counselor, someone who the students know, and that, see if there's some kind of release of information where they can communicate and advocate on their, behalf of the student. I know, because we're a small school and the students that go to our community college come back to me to get help to register for school. They don't go to the advisor at the college. I don't know that the advisors at the college are trained to work with high school students who don't understand the process. I had several that just went to the two-hour introduction that they had to do for the community college, and they came back and did not understand anything that happened during that meeting. And sitting down one-on-one with those students, I was able to help them register for classes, kind of talk to them about the difference in writing and reading in each of the different courses, and maybe what they might want to start with, some advice as far as how many credits and what is full-time and what's part-time. And, I think I've said before that my caseload's over 800, so having to do that on top of my normal caseload, I want to do it for the kids. But if we had a transition counselor that was really designed to help them, someone that they had developed relationships with kind of throughout that senior year, it would be really powerful. We're still waiting to hear if we've gotten the federal Gear Up dollars, but one of the things I'm most excited about if we do is that seventh year program where we have that transition year built in to try to help some of those students. Those are some things that I've seen. As far as our kind of other program, our life skills program, I think that Newport High School has an incredible program. I'd encourage you to visit, your staff to visit. We're a pretty spread out district. We have four public schools, and most of the students that qualify for the program come to Newport to take part in it because we have such it's just such an amazing program. That they do all kinds of things, dog treats, so they make dog treats. They make lunches and sell them to pay for that. So I have lunch delivered every Wednesday, and it's great lunch. They make bird houses, and so they've partnered with our woodshop teacher who teaches them basic woodshop skills and then allows them to use the woodshop after that class for that. I have an amazing boy named Elijah who comes in and gets my shredding every week. I miss him so much during the summer. If we could continue summer school. I mean, he says hi, he draws me pictures. We really have developed a relationship where he's learning how to communicate, ask, you know, figuring out if it's an appropriate time to come into my office or am I working with a student. So he's having to learn a lot of those types of skills. What I have seen from our program developer, though, is she is exhausted. She may have probably 60 kids in the program for a small, we are a small rural school. And because she wants it to be amazing, she's there at 5 in the morning, she's leaving at 7 o'clock at night, she's there. Because in order to teach and to develop the programs, it takes so much time. And that community outreach has been huge. So, she's really, each year develops a new program. I wish for our district that we could afford to have a program coordinator. That was her job, that she wasn't also additionally trying to teach throughout the day, because I think our program would be so much more amazing. But anyway, I can connect you with her if you're interested.
Oh, yeah.
And so we have kind of a 7th through 9th grade program, a 10th through 12th grade program. We have a transition program. We have a structured learning center, and we have an apartment living skills also. So they do, learn how to cook and clean and go shopping and do that part as well. But they're also out in job sites. And those are the sorts of things that take a lot of time, setting up all of those services in a small community when we don't have a lot, we don't have transportation. There's so many things that are kind of hard. And it's, the program's called Excel, and I don't remember what it stands for, but that's the program we have in Lincoln County.
Any other on the phone? Oh, yeah, Clint.
And about the coffee cart. We had a pretty successful coffee cart in McMinnville area through the Willamette ESD and the YTP program. So if you want, I can connect you with the YTP specialist. She could tell you more about that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So, Matt, is the issue that the coffee cart would be at the high school and the customers would be the students and we have the nutritional standards for snacks?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the customers, I think, would be staff, which is okay, but students would be a little frustrated to not be able to get involved in that, too. And some of the power, from my view, is our, gen ed kids being able to go get a coffee. From our transition kids, because they are friends. I mean, we have the opposite problem, and it eventually peaked. We're going to have to deal with the fact those our kids are comfortable coming back, and at some point we're going to need to cut the cord. We just don't have facilities right now to have it. I don't know why a senior student can't buy a cup of coffee from
from Fred Meyer in the corner would support the establishment of an
exactly right. Yeah, that's another third of the high school goes to the Starbucks in the Fred Meyer that's 100 yards away.
If you're in Corvallis, don't go to the Fred Meyer during the lunch hour at CHS. You will never buy anything.
That's true.
Who eat?
But I've seen schools that have had it, and so I don't know if it's our district has a very aggressive interpretation of different regulations. It seems to me, on a lot of levels. But I mean, I've been in Silverton High School, which has a coffee cart. So yeah.
Currently, I think it's housed at Sheridan High School, which is, again, a very small high school.
Oh, yeah. And I'll see how they do it. Their superintendent's a good friend of mine, actually.
So it sounds like this is an area that probably needs to be added to our recommendations. There's kind of a placeholder in there, but I'm hearing a number of things that could probably get pulled out. kind of connectors between the high school and the community college, looking at the barriers to dual enrollment between the high school and community college for a student that has a modified diploma and maybe has some barriers around the Compass and other placement tests. I already said the connector, kind of the transition counselor, looking at any regulatory barriers to businesses, student-run businesses that might take place in schools. What we forgot to put in, and you raised it, was the grant funding, looking at how do we do the testing, who's responsible for the testing, how do we have that all set up for the kids, because that's going to be this population of kids more than the other population of kids. And probably something that's really explicit, looking at the population of kids with a modified diploma who are not life skills, where it's not an intellectual disability. These are our kids with learning disabilities, our kids with ADHD, probably some of our kids with sensory disabilities as well. How are we specifically looking at those kids and connecting them into 40-40-20 and post-secondary opportunities? Does that, what, Mike?
Yeah, I would, I think the other part here, and I think that you had briefly touched on this, is how do we support and encourage access to community-based job experiences? Yeah. And some of the perceptions, real or imagined, that employers may have, whether it's the insurance question or others, I think that is a key, regardless of the support needs of the particular student. And I think the other thing that was mentioned is, and I think this is a broader systems question, but how do we support summer activities for students, whether that's supported through the school structure or through our local, you know, workforce investment boards or through VR, that not only provides, that potentially provides paid work experience for students during the summer. I think those keys are really important, and it may take more conversation around those things, but those are central in my view.
Well, and the VR piece that you just mentioned and that Matt mentioned as well, I think for the kids that are in the life skills program, because of the executive order, we have some pressure around bringing VR in earlier. These kids, too, would really benefit from that. So looking across the spectrum, not just in the IDDD population, how are we connecting VR?
Exactly. I think that if you look, you know, we're tweener, if you look at the, you know, the array of the needs of students, I think some of the cross-cutting opportunities need to be those community-based, you know, job experiences and paid work experiences in the summer, and that to me cuts across.
Oh yeah.
You know, the total, well, cuts across everybody. So I think focus on that's important.
Clint and then Senator Dimbro.
Yeah, we have an amazing YTP specialist in McMinnville, and she's the only one. There's a second YTP specialist who works just a day and a half. So Kathy's pretty much the face of YTP, and she put together a one-month paid work experience at the WESD building this summer, where she had six transition students working every day, doing grounds maintenance, painting, pressure washing, and was there with them, working alongside them, teaching them work skills and safety and all that sort of stuff. And it was an amazing success. And they all left after that month with a paycheck and a month worth of work for a resume. You know, work experience, so they can kind of narrow that job focus, which with high school students changes kind of on a daily basis. But yeah, it was a great experience. So I feel lucky to be in McMinnville and have her as a YTP specialist.
So Senator Dimbro and then Mike.
Great. Yeah. Oh, I very much like what I'm hearing about ramping up the connection with the work experience and figuring out ways to get employers to buy in, be part of the team. Just to change the subject, something I've been concerned about, well, for a long time, but it seems like more and more, is the problem of student debt, you know, when they go to college. And, you know, this committee, you know, did some exciting work early on, you know, in terms of clarifying access to financial aid for students with modified diplomas or I do worry about students taking on debt and then not having the capacity to repay that debt. I mean, you know, I'm fully supportive of them getting grants, you know, and thereby allowing them to, you know, to be part of higher education. We have a growing problem, however, with people defaulting on their loans because, you know, A, for the most part, they're students who don't complete their programs. I think that's the biggest problem. But then also those who are not able to secure employment at a level that allows them to repay their loans. So I'm just wondering if we haven't really touched on that problem specifically here. And I don't have a sense of whether that is a particular problem with students, you know, coming out of the, you know, various special needs routes. And I wonder if anybody has a sense of that. Do you have an anecdotal sense of this being a problem? Is there, you know, is this something we should somehow be addressing in terms of the college's role in, I mean, should they be facilitating students taking out loans? I mean, it's not always, the college doesn't always have a response, doesn't always have a role, particularly when we're talking about private loans that are being taken out. So that's just a lot I'm throwing at you.
I can only speak from Voc Rehab's perspective, but I'm working with a young man right now who we're just getting him into his first term at Jamaica, and when I was meeting with him during this last few months, we have a checklist that we go through with our clients, whether they're a young person or a middle-aged or whatever, about entering higher education. We want them to be sure they understand why they're going in and that they're hooking up with the disability liaison and all that stuff. But he didn't understand that grants didn't have to be paid back, and so he hadn't even applied for the Pell Grant, even though he has a regular diploma. So we got that cleared up, but then his parents make so much money that he didn't qualify for the Pell Grant. But fortunately, Voc Rehab never requires a client to take out student loans. We don't consider any of that money towards unmet needs for college, and then so that allows me then to help him pretty much with everything except for some basic books and stuff. Because of his parents' income, they do have to contribute something, but I cover most of the cost of the college and the fees and things like that. So please, I know Voc Rehab isn't the only answer or the answer, but please send your transition students to Voc Rehab because we can help if they want to get into college. So, and they won't have to take on a huge amount of student debt. So,
well, I think, oh, Mike.
Senator, I would, I don't have an anecdotal response as in terms of a current issue, but I would certainly project it as a future concern, because I think our strategic goals should be that more kids would go on to post-secondary education than what we've seen, you know, in the past. So I think it may not necessarily be a problem today, but it's one to keep on the radar for tomorrow if we're successful in kind of the direction we think things should head.
I was just going to say maybe it's something that could be addressed through like an early college program where they're in high school still but taking college level classes and maybe achieving success in a collegiate setting at an earlier phase in their educational career versus at the end where they finish up high school, they've got their modified diploma, and then all of a sudden now they're thrown out into this world of college and, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate that. Maybe it's something that could be addressed, whether it's in like a resource classroom or something, like you said, through like an early college or a transition person to help prepare them for what lies ahead and showing them that success is possible and achievable at an earlier age.
Well, it may be too, I think Mike's point that hopefully, I mean, we don't want anybody to have this problem. Right now it's hard to have the anecdotal evidence because we have so few that are able to pursue post-secondary, and there's a little bit of a success when kids with disabilities have the same problems as everybody else. So I wouldn't want to create a new barrier by setting a higher standard for a student with disability to access a loan than another student with the assumption that they would be more likely to default than another population. So a different way to get at it might be in looking at how we're better addressing this issue across the board with all students in high school as they're preparing to move on to post-secondary with basic consumer finance information and making sure within that that we're reaching out to key subgroups to be sure that we are including those groups of individuals and making sure that students with disabilities are kind of part of that group that's being brought into those kinds of conversations about managing debt, deciding whether or not it's a good thing to take on or not.
Chair Gelser, I was looking through the recommendations here, and there's one that I made a note of that I think we talked about it at one point, is also how can community colleges or universities start to look at offering post-secondary opportunities for maybe some of our students who might previously might be served in our life skills programs, because we need to build a plan for the kids who we're kind of not having a plan for, which are our modified diploma graduates who can go on to post-secondary, and they'll go through the typical channels of taking some of the typical courses for certificate programs. But we have another population of students, which we kind of are managing really well in our high school setting, but once they turn 21, there's not options. So I think about I think we all saw the Facebook post of the young man who got into, I think, like University of Illinois, and they have a very specific program that targets kind of life skills and community-based living at the university level. And we don't have that in Oregon. There's one program at PCC Sylvania or Rock Creek right now, but it's one professor who's manning it. It's a culinary arts program. And when that person retires, they're not intending to maintain that program. So it is something that as we look at universities supporting students with disabilities, how could they also look at this level? That could be an option. That would be great. And I would imagine Voc Rehab would love, that option as well for their clients who are coming there.
Definitely, yes.
So it's just something to, I think like Roberta Dunn has managed to do some work with her son through BACT. And with down in Eugene and Lane County, but we don't really have that. You have to have a parent who's willing to push for that and is able to do that. And how do we build some more of those opportunities?
I attended a conference a couple of years ago where they had several of these programs from around the country that were there, and I admittedly had been a little bit skeptical of the programs. And what struck me was, in our culture, college has become a real rite of passage. Moving into the dorm, it's the place where you learn different types of independent skills and social skills. And as these students talked about living with a roommate, going to the cafeteria, managing work and school, and the programs that each of the young people were working on were very different. I mean, some were very, very academic. Others were more focused on some type of a career certificate. But it was really extraordinary to see how it worked and how well prepared these individuals were, not just to work, but also to live independently. Because college, you go away to college, there's a lot of independent living skills that you're getting there while you're still there's structure, some protection that's there.
And you have job opportunities. I mean, at a university level, there's so many valuable job experiences that are part of that. I mean, it would be good to see in the state of Oregon if we're able to look at some of those opportunities, because a lot of the students, when they leave our program, for that population, we're doing a really good job for, but then they turn 21, and who knows when they leave us. And maybe even before they turn 21, I mean, they're graduating with their friends and they may want an opportunity to start transitioning to college. And how are we doing that in the system? And we just don't have that set up.
Well, should we move on to the conversation about the recommendations at this point to see what we've, I think we have. good bridge, Danielle. So should we start back at the top, move through, and I know there's things that are missing and that are not clear here, so just destroy the document and rebuild it, please. So the first one went back to some of our earlier meetings around eligibility for modified and extended diplomas. We talked about the issue of the disconnect between the intention of that early identification of eligibility being to avoid kids getting these because of credit deficiency, but the problem that's created being kids are put on a track when they might be able to switch out. So these recommendations were around clarifying and finding ways to ensure that that decision that's documented is just the decision that the student is eligible. It's not the decision that that student will get that. And then kind of building on that, improving communication around the goal continues to be, even for students who are eligible for a modified diploma or an extended diploma, that they reach the most rigorous diploma possible. I don't even remember what this third bullet means. Can somebody help?
Well, there's now an essential skills overlay
right.
to the credits. So is that how it works, that a student can have the right number of credits, but they don't meet the essential skills, and so they will get a modified diploma?
Yes.
Didn't that have something to do with the
Yes. Yes, because that's what it was. So she did not want to pursue a modified diploma. She wanted a standard diploma. And she
then demonstrate she couldn't pass Oaks. Mm-hmm. And then the work sample, she was struggling with the work sample, although she had already passed the math class and got the grade, but she was struggling with the work sample, which is the alternative route for demonstrating the essential skills.
And thanks to all of your work and those conversations, we kind of identified the issue of districts not allowing the accommodations on the work samples. So that had an emergency clause for this spring. She did then, with her work samples passed, she graduated and she's enrolled in college, which is really kind of exciting. I really liked it when I got a copy of her graduation picture. That was really fun.
So what exactly is meant then on this bill bullet if I look at?
Right. I think that this was around if a student I think what this started with was you have the kid in the 8th or the 9th grade or the 10th grade and you're talking about whether or not they're eligible for the modified diploma. And sometimes in looking at whether or not to make that decision, if the student isn't doing well on testing, some kids are being pushed into the modified diploma at that point in time. And then they're getting the modified credits and it doesn't put them on the pathway to a regular diploma because of how they've performed previously on their standardized assessments. So I think this was how do we make sure that performance on a standardized assessment isn't preventing a student from continuing to strive for that regular diploma. And I think it tied back to the conversations about availability for a work sample and the conversations that we had at the very beginning about, you know, the policies as they're written might make sense, but how that information gets down to the school level where people are trying to figure out how to interpret the rules and some uniformity across the state for kids to be able to access them.
And for early, I think families need to know early on that there are multiple options of passing essential skills, but because of the high-stake testing and the school districts wanting to have good scores on the report cards,
right.
they're pushing some students really hard. You have to pass this to graduate. That's kind of the message.
Right.
And so for those students that we're finding eligible at an early age, I mean, really everyone, that they need to know that that is
right.
not the only way, but that is often the message at our parent meetings and around the district in newspapers. I mean, that you have to pass it. Well, there are other options.
Right.
So identifying them early.
Well, and I just recalled the other piece of what I think this is about. For Natalie, one of the other issues that she faced because she really did not want she didn't want a modified diploma, so they refused to sign the eligibility form for that modified diploma. So even though she certainly was eligible based on who she was and it wasn't a credit deficiency, they hadn't identified her as eligible for that modified diploma. So as she came to the end, she wasn't necessarily eligible to walk because she had done all these things and hadn't done that eligibility. So I think that was the other thing here, is that it's not just the credits and what classes you can take. And going back to, it's not a determination you're getting the modified diploma, it's just a documentation of the eligibility that it's not because you're credit deficient. So clearly that needs work from someone that can write better than I can.
Rip Springer.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. My question's more of a process question. As I was going through this document, these recommendations, and making notes, although I agree with many of them, I'm thinking process, what, other than just a recommendation, what is it we're going to do with this? And some of the recommendations either appear to be aspirational goals or conceptual ideas. And so I'm wondering what we're looking at creating here to go to a committee to draft into language for statute. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think not all of these things would be statutory. You know, at one of the meetings, so for instance, the high school transcripts, the question was, do we really need a bill to do that? The law already says that this should be occurring. So what is the work that we may need to be doing with the Department of Ed? So this document really is trying to capture the things that we had the meetings, there was some consensus around the table, these are things that need to change. I think my hope today is we can make sure we've captured everything or these things are accurate, and that then we can have a smaller group that works on piecing these things out. What are recommendations for the Department of Ed? What are recommendations that would require some sort of a statutory work? What are recommendations for the Department of Human Services or Voc Rehab or the community colleges that might not require a statutory change? I think in general, anything that we can do without a statutory change is better, because there's a lot more flexibility if we don't get it right. And the more we put in the statute, I think the harder your jobs get to be. I like that. So that would be, does that answer your question?
Less is more.
Yeah.
By way of statute. Yeah.
Can I just follow up on that? So to what extent is, you know, the success of, you know, students with disabilities part of the conversation on the OEIB? Do you know? I mean, and, you know, we have an expert here, but, you know, I mean, I assume that, you know, the equity lens is applied to this population of students. And, you know, given that the OEIB's purpose is to focus on student success and transitions, you know, from one sector to another, you know, it seems that, I mean, going back to Sherry's question about next steps, you know, I'd be interested to know, I'd be interested to see these issues addressed by the OEIB in some way.
That'd be great. And I think that, and I think to the question of the OEIB and the equity lens, I think we added language after a presentation to the Education Committee around students with disabilities. I think one of the challenges, though, is that in the agendas for OEIB and the compacts and discussions about the achievement gap, you know, the Secretary of State just did an audit on the achievement gap. Students with disabilities are never included. I mean, they are never included in the list of subgroups. They are never included in the list of gaps. There will be information that says the largest gap in graduation or the largest gap in third grade reading is X group, when that's not true. It's actually students with disabilities over and over and over again. So I think one of the things that would be helpful that I hope that changes at the OEIB is that there's more than just the words in the equity lens, but actually in the practice and in the meetings, a recognition that the population exists as a subgroup.
And it is now with the research group. They have split out the
Great. Excellent. That's great. Thank you. And these will go to the OEIB, because the way that we crafted the bill, the recommendations for appointment for this group actually came through OEIB instead of through ODE. Yeah. Other questions about process? And I think it also requires that we deliver the report to the OEIB. So it goes to the OEIB, ODE, and us in the end.
Yes. And I hope that it includes some expectations of the OEIB in the recommendations.
That's a good idea.
So should we go back? Rather than going through line by line, what if people just read it and pop up with what you think is missing, what doesn't make sense, or maybe is not accurately captured from the discussions? Yeah, Representative Springer.
Maybe this is just revealing my ignorance here, but on number three, transition, it talks about making available access to certain links. Brokerages, I think I might know what we're talking about, but I'd like to hear that. And guardianships. What would those links be? Who would those organizations be?
So I think this is, again, lost in the bad writing. It wasn't necessarily links to the organization, but information about how they work. So at transition time, so the guardianships first. At transition time, families and individuals have a lot of decisions to make around guardianship and conservatorship. And there, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about that. And it's an expensive and interesting process. We just went through it. So the idea was getting that information to people so that they're able to do it on time. And there have been some issues in some districts around the timing of that, where families haven't been able to continue to access IEP meetings or education records because they don't have the guardianship, and the person then is their own person and they can't necessarily sign to allow permission for their parents to participate. On the brokerages, when students turn 18, they're eligible for support services if they have intellectual and developmental disabilities. And this would be, how do you access that eligibility? What's the process for accessing adult services? Who do you call? A lot of this stuff is in a book that Sally Simich brought. And many people around the table had never seen the book.
Right.
It was a really good book. And it's hard to distribute a book.
Again. And people don't flip through the pages, typically. That's helpful. Thank you.
Anybody want to add anything on either of those?
I do have a question.
Yeah.
How about, students who were in guardianship, or actually, I'm thinking particularly of foster youth. So have we talked specifically about kids who are foster youth who are then transitioning out of that, you know, being part of the foster youth program? Because we did, you know, I'm just reminded, we did pass legislation a couple of sessions ago that gives free tuition to students who are foster youth. And, you know, a level of support. So they go to college or university tuition free. And I wonder if we should maybe reference that somewhere here. I would assume that there are a number of students with IEPs who are in foster situations, and I wonder how that bumps up against what we're talking about here.
Well, and an interesting question of that, too, would be how that is drafted, if it's just child welfare foster care, if it also includes SPD. Foster care. So there. So in our DD and physical disability system, an individual who may need a higher degree of support, or the family needs respite, will go into foster care for a while, or permanently, has nothing to do with abuse and neglect. And I wonder if they're encompassed, which would be a really interesting question, because that could be a great.
And I'm thinking we have families who don't necessarily know how to access those resources. So what ends up happening is you may have an adult who wants to go into an adult foster facilitated kind of living situation, which might be great for them outside of their parents' home, and parents don't always know how to access that. And then what happens for that adult when they get in the adult foster home? I mean, we haven't really looked into that, because some of the issues then are you'll have adults who then are in with developmental disabilities who are in adult foster home, but they're their own guardian. I mean, they're responsible for themselves and kind of the dynamics that happen along with that. And the relationship with schools and then post-secondary is kind of, you probably have a little bit more in terms of that, do you?
I haven't worked with any youth that have been in the foster care system. I have worked with some traumatic brain injury adults that were in foster care. And the thing with foster care is if there are behavioral issues, it's one thing if the person can, you know, behave, you know, not cause problems, but if there are behavioral issues, they will burn through many foster care facilities. And like my one client ended up way out of the community. I think he's in, I don't even know what city he's in, where they finally found one that would take him because of his behavioral issues after he'd burned through like three or four other foster care facilities. So basically it allowed him to become isolated from his family is what it did. And so not a real good outcome for him.
Good catch.
Susan.
Also in the transition area, when you list just OSAC, it's probably more than that.
Okay.
It should probably expand to do financial aid for college or financial aid for post-secondary education, which is probably even better than saying for college, because that would include something besides, you know, a bachelor's degree in something or other. And I think also going along with that, financial literacy, which Senator Dembro touched on a little bit with the student loan debt issue. I know that a number of the community colleges and also our agency are looking at partnering with organizations that are in the business of financial literacy and kind of building up programs to help students and their families, for that matter, understand more about the whole financial aid process and go beyond just financial aid for college, but budgeting and borrowing and all of those things connected with it.
Sure. Yeah, with respect to number four, you know, following up on the conversation before, you know, I think it would be good for us to recommend just better relationships, more kind of ongoing relationships between transition counselors and people working at the high school level and the community college and university level, that those need to be more than haphazard.
Yeah. Representative Springer.
Any title works. Are you finished with that topic? Okay. So looking at number five, and I noticed there's an asterisk there, and I'm not picking on things. I'm asking, was there a reason that asterisk was there?
I think because
that's a broad concept.
I think because there's not a second thing, and I don't know how to put in a bullet point, so I do the asterisk, space, space, and then I return and do another one, and then it automatically makes bullet points.
I love that answer. It's so real.
Okay. Clarifies.
Did I mention something about the transcript?
Yeah.
I think it's worth noting, and I don't know if there's a solution to this issue overall, but in addition to kind of non-uniformity, the variation in district transcripts, we have huge variation in interstate, transcripts and things like that. We have a lot of students who move in and out of state, and decoding some of the transcripts is extremely difficult at times and can cause a great amount of work. And I don't, like I said, I don't know how to attack that problem necessarily, but I think it's certainly worth noting that there's a large amount of interstate variation in how transcripts are formatted.
Good point.
Chair Gelser, I was thinking on here, and you, in number five, you talk about kind of people on the front lines, and I wonder if there needs to be somehow a theme, somehow really highlighting the need of the ownership of the success of these students on not special ed, but the general education community. You know, it goes to that conversation about OEIB, and I think the recommendations that come out from this transition from our work will, you know, may go to OEIB, may go to ODE, and where it will get funneled through will be through the special education section of ODE, which will then get funneled back to me. But Matt may never hear about it, and may, you know, he will own it because that's who Matt is, but other people won't. Right. And I think we need to somehow highlight that theme of ownership that isn't just owned by special ed. So, you know, how do you communicate out, you know, when you talk about transcripts, you talk about transition services, how is that bigger than just special ed? Because I think that is one of the barriers and roadblocks we run into, whether it's from a special ed department or from a building principal's perspective who's trying to figure out how to navigate or merge some of these special services within, you know, a comprehensive high school.
And I wonder if that should be something that's encompassed in recommendations, but also in the narrative. And one of the things that might be interesting in the structure of the document is to talk about, kind of by name or category, what are the roles or the organizations or people that play a role in post-secondary success. What is the role of the high school counselor? What is the role of the registrar? What is the role of the principal? What is the role of the gen ed teacher? What is the role of the financial aid officer? And all of those are not special ed.
Right.
And I think most of the people that are going to impact post-secondary success for a student with disability are non-special ed. So if there's a way that we can really call that out and start to highlight what some of those responsibilities are, and when we distribute the report to ODE and OEIB, one of the recommendations to ODE and OEIB at the beginning be disseminate this report, not just to special ed, but to all of these other folks.
And I wonder if there's a role for board of directors, school boards as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, everybody. I gotta go. I'm late for another committee.
Those senators.
And I apologize for being late. I was in emergency board until about 15 minutes ago. So.
Sorry. Welcome, Cindy. And did
you
want to introduce
yourself?
It was
really boring. It was really, really boring.
They were boring emergencies.
Well, e-board is not always emergencies. It's just decisions that need to be made in the interim, financial decisions. So,
do you want to introduce yourself to the group?
Chris Edwards, state senator from Eugene. Enough said.
Great. And so, as Senator Dimbrough was leaving, he also suggested that we talk about more partnerships with business and labor in general, and I think that also would encompass some of the conversation that we had today. Mike's suggestions around kind of community-based work placements, and I think that again is looking at what are some of those barriers that are in place around regulations and insurance, all of those kinds of things. And I think the other thing from today that's not explicit in here is looking at what is the role for Running Start programs or 5 or 6 year collaborations with community colleges for students with disabilities. What kind of student supports are available? How might the financing work? What does that do about prerequisites if the prerequisite is a diploma? I mean, is there a way we could get a kid that doesn't have a diploma because of math, maybe they could get their 2 year certificate and they'll leave and they won't have a high school diploma, but they'll have a post-secondary certificate.
And to add to that Running Start piece, I mean, there, in terms of that partnership, there has to be more individualization with kids. I was just talking with our metals teacher this week, and both of his kids are in Running Start. He loves it. He's going free college, great. But they're not on IEPs at all. But he has a kid who he knows will not meet the math essential skills, and this kid just wants to become a welder. And the context of that conversation was, he uses trigonometry all the time. He just doesn't know it because in the industry, their settings, they look them up. And so, I mean, the kid should be able to get a welding certificate through LB, but he can't, he doesn't qualify for Running Start because of the math placement issue. And he's probably not going to pay for it on his own. And so we need to get use a little more imagination, especially through the lens of 40-40-20. What we can get this kid work ready. I mean, he is work ready, but he can't, he won't, without Running Start, he can't afford to be deemed work ready. So I'd like that to be part of it, too.
Mike's kind of excited over there.
But just to support the point and connect it, Representative Gelsford, to what you just said about the importance of the community work placements, and even to the, some of the community college, the broader array of opportunities we can provide, then the more we can match with the individual preferences and strengths and desires. Of, so there's a direct relationship between the importance of looking at those and expanding the array of community-based experiences for folks and doing that kind of matching along strengths and interest of students, you know, for that longer-term success. I think it's kind of that dotting the I on that that concept. And the other thing I would say, and I'm kind of, you know, learning to speak special education a little bit and kind of learning the system, which has been great sitting on this, but it seems like in some ways the nature of the work is evolving a little bit and changing a little bit in terms of these expectations, and that's going to have to be resourced in some way, or the consideration around that. You know, if we have people coming in at 5 a.m. and leaving at 7 because they're teaching 80 kids and then trying to do these other things, I mean, this is work that has to be recognized as the next generation of effort or expectations, and somehow, I don't know the proper way to, I'm sure that'll get conveyed somewhere in respect to these recommendations, but that's just a reality that somewhere has to be.
Good point.
How can you make that resource not affect your maintenance of effort, which may be the concern of the school district?
Right.
But that you're looking at a continuum of services for all students that you would for college and career readiness, and you're including students with disabilities in there, so it doesn't necessarily have to fall into that special education component.
And I think that resourcing manifests in lots of different ways. I mean, there's the day-to-day work. There's how do you release teachers for the training that's going to be, you know, necessary. How does that relate to the training that new teachers are receiving as they're coming into, you know, the system to convey or to perpetuate, you know, the kinds of, so it's just like you all know, it's a multifaceted question. It's not with easy answers, but it just needs to be recognized.
I have a great partnership with our community college, but again, we're really small, and maybe I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I meet with the community college advisors, and if I have a student that doesn't pass Math 60 or to get into that class, but I know through all of the other recommendations from the teachers or everything else that the student would be successful in a particular class, I call the advisors and ask them to waive I ask them to override the requirement. And so, you know, I have students that earned a CNA one last year that could not pass the reading entrance exam, but it was a hands-on practical experience. And yes, it took a lot of work for our specialists to work with that student for the state board because they have to have a high level of reading, but we got them, you know, accommodations for that reading exam, and they graduated and are able to work in the field. So I think, you know, if you can create those partnerships, the thing is the partnerships take so much time, you know, but if you can get that, it's amazing. I hope that the students can start to experience some of those.
You know, it would be really helpful for the report too, in terms of that narrative, is a couple of those unique kinds of explanations of this is why. Because I think for most people to think, well, a CNA that can't pass the reading exam, would I want them to be my CNA? Kind of describing in that vignette why that works, why the hands-on practical application works. If you talk about the welding kid, just to kind of put a practical face on what it is that needs to get accomplished and how it is being accomplished in other places would be really helpful. Which brings us to the next part. Who wants to be on the writing team? Don't all volunteer at once.
Oh,
well. Yay! Yeah.
I don't know that I understand the expectation as far as how often and when and that kind of thing, so I don't know.
So I think a lot of it could be done via email because it's a smaller group and not the whole group. And the expectation is to write it in a way that makes sense to people in the system that we want to get it to. And, you know, this... to have it not look like this, to include all the things that we've forgotten, and to really add the narrative that tells the story. And I'm happy to help, but I think I used the wrong words. And the point of this committee really was to bring the people together that are doing the work, and for the people doing the work to find the right words to describe where we need to go next. I think makes sense, and Victoria can be helpful in the process too, right?
Sure.
Thanks. Great.
I'm happy to help. Yeah, okay. It's not a lot of
okay, great.
Who else volunteering? I missed it.
It's almost a whole group.
You're volunteering too, Erin?
Erin is too.
Student. And I'm happy to be on.
Let's remember the bullet points get read more than long.
Yes. Yeah.
Also.
So. Yeah. So there should be like an executive summary and a pullout of okay, and what do you want from me at the end?
Can I share a happy story that actually comes out of this work? So I ran into a girl in the office who graduated 2 years ago from Corvallis High School, had to take a modified diploma because, you know, in 4 years and a lot of work, she just had 1 year of algebra and one semester geometry, and that was it. Got a modified diploma. She wasn't held to, she was the last class, didn't have to meet the essential skill, the benchmark, but didn't have 3 years of math to go to college. So got a modified diploma. She'd been admitted to, wanted to go to Cornish Art Institute in Seattle, and because she couldn't access financial aid, couldn't go. But with changes to that, she was in getting a transcript, and she started this week at Portland Art Institute with financial aid, and she can go. And she'll never take a math class for the rest of her life, but she's going to email me when her art shows open, and I'll go up to the Pearl and see it. So it's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So we will connect with those of you that have boldly volunteered to be on the writing team and set up the next steps within the next week. And is there anything else for the good of the order that people want to talk about today? Yes, Clint.
I'm just really pleased to be on a task force committee that actually accomplished something. Thanks to you, Senator Gelser. You kind of spearheaded that. I'm Representative Gelser, sorry.
Go home.
Yeah, so... my first task force, I'm just proud to have been on it.
Well, thank you all for doing it. It's been nice to be on a task force where people come and remain engaged in the work and get excited. I think it says a lot about the folks that are working with our kids. I think one of my favorite moments of this was the presentation that you two gave about just the work that's happening that we don't always see. And, you know, our kids do well not just because of the people that stand in front of them every day, but the people that support that work, and just the way that you describe your advocacy for your kids is really inspiring. So thank you very, very much for doing it and caring so much and making a difference for them and a lot of other kids too, and everybody else here. So with that, we're adjourned. Thank you all.